Falls, W228EP Eau Claire, and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Peter King. A day after a U.S.-British-led coalition attacked dozens of Houthi targets in Syria and Iraq, the Houthis have held true to their promise that they would answer those strikes with more of their own. CBS News national security correspondent David Martin says their first attempt never got off the ground.
Only hours after being hit by U.S. and British aircraft and missiles, the Houthis tried again to attack commercial shipping in the Red Sea. The U.S. military says at 4 a.m. local time this morning, it struck a Houthi anti-ship cruise missile as it was being prepared to launch. The attempted launch came just 4.5 hours after the U.S. and Britain struck 36 targets, including underground ammo bunkers, in an attempt to eliminate, or at least degrade, the Houthis' ability to threaten commercial ships. David Martin, CBS News, Washington.
Flood and high wind alerts are up in much of California, with a big atmospheric river raining down on the state for the next couple of days. National Weather Service meteorologist Bob Orovec.
The rainfall is going to be heavy across a good part of the state. Average amounts could probably be in the 3 to 5 inch range. But in some of the mountains north of Los Angeles and some of the mountains right along the coast, the totals could be anywhere from 6 to 10 inches.
KCBS-TV's Kara Finstrom.
In L.A. County, crews are concerned about the L.A. River swelling and water sweeping people off the banks. They've been reaching out to folks experiencing homelessness who live in encampments, asking them to head to shelters for the next few days.
At the Vatican, Pope Francis is among those praying for an end to the forest fires ravaging central Chile. They're blamed for at least 64 deaths and the loss of more than 1,100 homes. Chile's president says he expects those numbers to go higher. The border crisis has led to a bipartisan Senate deal that negotiators say will help ease the problem. Arizona independent Kyrsten Sinema helped negotiate the bill and spoke about it on CBS's Face the Nation.
We'll make swift justice. Folks who do qualify for asylum will be on a rapid path, 6 months or less, to start a new life in America. And those who do not qualify will quickly be returned to their home countries.
In South Carolina, President Biden's supporters are looking to November after his big win in the state's Democratic primary. On the Republican side, Donald Trump says he did not reach out to Robert F. Kennedy Jr. to gauge his interest in possibly being a running mate. South Dakota's governor is seen by many as filling that slot. Trump spoke about her on Fox News' Sunday Morning Futures.
Kristi Noem has been incredible fighting for me. She said, I'd never run against him because I can't beat him. That was a very nice thing to say.
And he's not saying who his running mate might be. This is CBS News.
Think O'Reilly Auto Parts for all your car care needs. Get the parts and service you need fast from the professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Covering all the news that affects you with humor and a unique perspective. Matinair on Air with Jane Matinair. Weekdays 10 till noon on the Talk of Eau Claire, 93.5 The Tap, and on the Civic Media app.
Oh. A new study finds a troubling link between racism online and higher rates of stress and suicide among Black youth. Terry D. reports.
Online racism includes jokes and misinformation, but also censorship or the removal of content posted by Black users. Psychologist Dr. Raquel Martin explains social media is often a representation of what is happening in everyday life.
Having social media provides you with an opportunity to see how people that look like you are being treated in their own city and state and country, and acknowledging the fact that that is not often good.
The study reveals Black teens with repeated exposure to racist posts internalize the content as threats, resulting in trauma-like symptoms and emotional distress. The Social Media Victims Law Center asserts that online anonymity and beliefs in digital freedom of speech are seen as justifications by those who post white supremacy ideology. Another study finds young people experience an average of 5 posts that include racial discrimination per day. Teens may see the content as teasing, not racial harassment, allowing cyberbullying to thrive. Martin says the apps commonly used by teens could do more to rein in the negative content.
I am not naive enough to think that individuals in the social media realm aren't aware of this. They're very much aware of it, but I also don't think they very much care. And a lot of the times the things they care about are losing money.
Recommendations to counter harmful online content include community faith-based and mentoring programs, and to address the stigma in the Black community of seeking therapy and connect teens to mental health resources geared toward youth. This is Terry D. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. Some fog and some clouds to begin your day. Eventually, skies turning partly cloudy. Our highs reaching the upper 40s. In the overnight, upper 20s and mostly clear skies. On Monday, we'll see more clouds on the way, upper 40s in the late afternoon. Currently 49 degrees.
You're tapped in to the issues affecting the Valley and all of Wisconsin. Consider us the bartenders of friendly local talk. This is 93.5 The Tap.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
UK.
Welcome. Grab your favorite morning beverage and join us for Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel.
You don't know me, but I'm your brother.
Good morning.
Sampling the news desserts of the week, here is your host, Jim Santel.
Good morning and welcome once again to our Saturday morning broadcast. This is the second hour of our discussion. This morning, talking a lot about civics and about the due process it has afforded litigants, both in the civil and criminal arena, including the comments made by the former President Donald Trump about his own experience in the federal district court recently in a civil matter, talking a lot about the process by which our courts work, the role of judges in serving not only to administer cases, but making decisions under the evidence rules, making decisions about all sorts of things that are brought before the courts, ultimately brought before a jury to decide on the ultimate issues of fact that litigants are seeking. Right before the break, we're talking to Nick about his observation. He said that none of this is new. There is a lot of this that has always been the subject of discussion and debate. Nick was making the point, of course, that presidents, as I interpret it, have often been frustrated by the Congress and so have done things in their official executive positions that have been the subject of litigation in front of the courts, and that too in the trial courts and the federal district courts, the circuit courts, the appellate courts across the land can always be the subject of litigation. In the particular instance that we have right now involving Donald Trump, none of these involve his express official activities and behaviors, and that in fact underlies the reason for much of this, if not all of this, litigation. Courts finding that indeed when you engage in the kind of conduct in which Donald Trump engaged when it comes to not only defamation, but also when it comes to January 6th, things related to an attempt to overthrow the results of the 2020 election, those are things not done during the course of duties and responsibilities as a president, and therefore, can indeed be the subject of individual personal liability, criminal liability in our federal district and also our state courts out there. Nick, appreciate the comment. Let's also take some more callers calling in this morning about the subject matter on our agenda. Let's hear from Dick. Dick calling in from Madison. Dick, glad to have you with me this morning. And Dick, we'll get to you in just a moment or so. We're going to continue our discussion here. We'll see if Dick is still on the line there. Dick from Madison, are you with us this morning?
Yep, I'm
all
here.
All right, great, Dick, we've got you. Thanks so much for calling in.
Great. What he would call due process, I call too long a leash, and here's why. After the first time last fall with the same person, Eugene Carroll, I read something that she had wrote that she basically, she's done well for herself in her own right financially. She doesn't really need the money per se. And basically what she was seeking is for him to cease and desist doing this stuff. And he never did, and he didn't continually. And now he does it through, okay, in a roundabout way, he's still going after her when he goes after the jury, goes after the judge, on and on and on. In my opinion, he should have been thrown in jail immediately the minute he started running his mouth. He's getting by with far more than any average person would get, in my mind. And I just don't understand why they didn't, you know. And then this excuse, oh, what could happen around the country? Well, what's happening anyway? And we're going to have to deal with this guy at some point. If he, in fact, is the nominee for president again, he's already said he won't accept losing.
Right. Lots of things, right, coming out of this. Lots of statements made by him that, again, are only contrary to our fundamental notions of how things work. But to your very good point, the remedies that come out of this. Coming out of the E. Jean Carroll case, as you know well, Dick, this huge component of punitive damages. Now, you recognize, as we all do, that in the civil cases, you can't throw somebody in jail. You can get money. You can get injunctive relief. The judges can order things to happen or not happen. Only in criminal cases can someone be incarcerated. The singular or significant exception to that, which we may see at some point down the road, came very close in a recent trial, is if someone is in contempt of court, even if it's in a civil case, under those circumstances, under appropriate process, a judge can indeed jail someone to respond to their contempt, even in a civil case. But that's not for the underlying charge in the civil case. But your larger point, Dick, is the important one. Why do we do all this? Why did E. Jean Carroll, as you just indicated, pursue this case? The particular dollar amount is perhaps, while it's colossal, is less significant than the message that it sends, which is no one should be permitted to get away with this in America, including especially somebody who has the bully pulpit of the presidency. He made these statements while he was in the Oval Office, denying he even knew her, denying the underlying events, all that kind of thing. And to your good point, Dick, the litigation process, the process of administration of rule of law, whether it is civil or criminal, needs to address that. And that's what this is all about. We talked again about the criminal case impending in front of Judge Shutkin. Likewise, it is meant to respond to the specific conduct, but it's also, to Dick, your very good important point, it's also meant to send a message, whether it's in 2024, 2025, that people who engage in this kind of thing and attempt to undermine the results of a legitimate election, that may well be the subject of charges against the next group of people. And that, too, is deterrence, not only, again, as to the individual defendant, but to other people out there, sending that message of deterrence. You can't do this. And that's the other reason why criminal prosecution, much like civil litigation, is important in our courts. And so appreciate that comment as well, Dick. And we also have calling in this morning, Mark. Mark, appreciate your being a part of our discussion this morning on our broadcast.
Yeah, it's certainly that as I've said before, that in Federalist 69, that Hamilton actually says the president would be subject to punishment and disgrace. I mean, he's not, he uses the word amenable, but that just means subject to in the context he was using. And this is all part of the whole Donald Trump shtick that we've been seeing for all these years. Any other person can maintain decorum in the court like Donald Trump has had. He's had no decorum. He's just complete contempt of court. He would be in jail. And we have to remember that this is all part of, you know, restoring him to office so he can pardon himself. And this is all linked into, you know, the whole conspiracy against our country that started actually before the last election is that, you know, they planned on Donald Trump, you know, he planned on never leaving office, and he conspired against the Constitution, the people of the United States, with the fake electors thing. Because he had them, you know, that the one thing he said when he was given his speech on the ellipse, said, go in peace. But before that, he had fired these people up. So that was just, you know, kind of an aside. It was just an aside. It was more of an aside, you know, kind of, you know, when Henry II made that flip comment, well, somebody rid me of this querulous monk, when he more or less ordered for Beckett to be killed. You know, Donald Trump had issued his orders, what he wanted people to do. And in my opinion, this is simply my opinion, but I think the whole fake electors thing was part of the conspiracy to overthrow the government of the United States. And I do not believe for a moment that those people that were engaged in being a fake electors misunderstood what they were doing. Right. I mean, from and the people who knew about what was going to happen, including Brian Schimming, the current Republican, Wisconsin Republican Party chair, knew that this stuff was going on, and their duty, their absolute duty, was to report this to law enforcement, to the people of the United States.
And we know, Mark, from, based upon exactly what you're saying, that this was a part of an overall scheme. We know about the attempt by the people surrounding Donald Trump, putting together this memorandum, first called the Wisconsin Memorandum, and later on this larger memorandum. The fake electors, a part of this overall scheme, including an attempt to coerce, if not actually compel somehow the vice president to throw out votes in the well of the Congress, all of it, reaching out to Georgia, reaching out to other places around the country, trying to get the electors off the proper electors off the scales and off the official tolls, and substituting these fake electors, all of that a part of this overall scheme designed in many ways by this fellow named Cheeseman, who is one of the unindicted co-conspirators in this case involving Donald Trump, pending right now in front of Judge Chutkan in the D.C. District Court. And so that brings us to what's going on then this coming week, directly related to all of this, this combination of the campaign going on in 2024, interspersed with all this litigation, including criminal and civil cases. What's happening next week in the United States Supreme Court? Thursday, February 8th. Mark your calendars. Thursday, February 8th, the Supreme Court is going to be entertaining oral argument on this case called Trump versus Anderson. And it is not a criminal case. It is different from the district court case, the criminal case that Mark and others and I were just chatting about, seeking to find Donald Trump criminally liable, criminally responsible for the events of January 6th. This is the one. This is the case in which there is a challenge to the decision by the Colorado Supreme Court to keep Donald Trump off the ballot for what? And here's how the connection comes in: for engaging in insurrection on January 6th and arguably right before that. The question, of course, in this case, Trump versus Anderson, is how you interpret Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, providing that no person will hold any office under the United States or under any state who, having previously taken an oath as an officer of the United States to support the Constitution, if you subsequently engage in insurrection or rebellion against the same. That's the constitutional provision that's been the subject of so much attention and litigation focus recently. In December, the Colorado Supreme Court, in this 4-3 decision, we've talked a lot about it, determined that Donald Trump was in fact ineligible, not appropriately, to have his name listed on the presidential primary ballot in that state, by virtue of an application of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. So all of this coming up before the United States Supreme Court next week. It's going to be a big week in the rule of law in the United States of America. So there are several legal issues. Arguably, you're going to be hearing about them in front of the Supreme Court when the folks, the individuals from Colorado who have been petitioning to keep him off the ballot, are in the same room with the attorneys for Donald Trump, seeking to have his name put back on the ballot in Colorado. What are those issues the Supreme Court will probably take up? First, there's an issue about political questions. Should the court at all adjudicate cases under the 14th Amendment or deem them political matters? The court has in the past, in many circumstances, has held that cases are what's called non-justiciable, political questions, when there is this perceived need to defer to the choices of other elected officials. So this is what's called the political question doctrine, and basically says that federal courts should not adjudicate a matter, doesn't bar state courts from doing the same thing. So, for example, a court held that challenges to partisan gerrymandering are non-judiciable political questions. Supreme Court found that recently and found instead that that's the kind of thing that state courts can address. When we come back, we're going to talk more about what's before the Supreme Court this coming week. Stay with us for that important discussion.
This is 93.5 The Tap.
It's Black History Month, and Civic Media supports the importance of this observance. But what do you really know about it? I'm Calvin Butenhoff, producer of The Earl Ingram Show. Our Echoes of Empowerment Black History Stories will offer thoughtful answers all month long. Now, here's Earl.
The story of Black History Month starts in Chicago. It's 1915 and thousands are there to celebrate. 50 years since the Emancipation Proclamation and the end of slavery. The gathering also inspires civic organizations to uncover the many achievements of Black citizens. By 1926, the celebration of African American history is official. This also is a time for rising racial pride. The Black middle class is expanding, and industrial cities like Milwaukee are luring African Americans with good jobs. There's so much more to tell you. Listen for the next Black History Month story here on Civic Media. I'm Earl Ingram.
You're listening to 93.5, The Tap.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Saturday morning broadcast, talking now about this big week coming up in the rule of law in America, including this major oral argument before the United States Supreme Court next week in this case called Trump versus Anderson. This is the one. This is the one in which the parties are arguing about whether or not Donald Trump's name can be on the Republican primary ballot in the state of Colorado. Colorado Supreme Court, again, previously saying that not only did Donald Trump engage in insurrection, but the application of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment is proper here, keeping him off the ballot. What kinds of things will the Supreme Court presumably be talking with the parties about when this coming Thursday they decide to entertain this case and talk with the parties about the merits and demerits of their positions? We talked right before the break about this political question doctrine, this notion that federal courts should not generally adjudicate a matter that is political in nature. And so, for example, partisan gerrymandering, court has said, or is a non-judicial, justiciable political question. State courts can do it, but not federal courts. And, of course, that would be a huge, huge disposition if indeed the court says this is a political question, we're not going to decide it at all. Second, another question they could decide is whether or not Section 3 of the 14th Amendment it requires some congressional legislation in order to be enforced. Who actually is responsible for enforcing this language under Section 3 of the 14th Amendment? 1869, there's a Chief Justice, Salmon Chase, who said that Section 3 was not self-executing. He wrote, "Legislation by Congress is necessary to give effect to the prohibition." Now, plainly, a lot of people agree with that. A lot of people disagree with that. But one of the issues that the Supreme Court may decide, or at least may wrestle with this coming week, ultimately decide, probably sooner rather than later, is whether or not Section 3 is self-executing, whether or not you need congressional legislation. And in fact, in 1883, the Supreme Court said the 14th Amendment is undoubtedly self-executing without any ancillary legislation, so far as its terms are applicable to any existing state of circumstances. That's what they said back in 1883. There's some precedent out there for this notion of a self-executing provision, not requiring legislation, not requiring a criminal conviction. But we'll see whether or not the Supreme Court pursues that particular precedent out there from way back in 1883. Third, here's another question coming up in Colorado that they could also entertain this coming week. Does Section 3 apply to the president? Now, this one strikes me and many other people as a fairly clear one in terms of its answer. You recall that the lower court judge in Colorado, she found that although there was an insurrection and that Donald Trump engaged in that insurrection, she looked at the language of Section 3 and said, you know what? This language of officer does not include the presidency. Awful lot of people, I would conclude myself among that group, scratch their head about that. And the question is whether or not the specific reference to office includes the presidency of the United States of America. Presumably, there may be questions about that particular applicability. And fourth, the big one, did Donald Trump engage in insurrection or rebellion using the language from that particular provision of the Constitution? Many, many aspects to that question. Does there need, as I said before, to be a criminal conviction as a predicate to finding insurrection or rebellion? Nothing in the language of the 14th Amendment says that, but maybe the Supreme Court imposes that requirement, even as it wrestles also with a legislative obligation to find, indeed, that it should be enforced. What, if anything, is the relevance of the House of Representatives having impeached Donald Trump on this, but the Senate not having convicted him? There again, I would offer, shouldn't be a major question, but maybe raised during the course of the oral argument.
Does it matter, as one of our callers said just a few moments ago, does it matter that Donald Trump's speech on the Ellipsis there that morning, arguably, from his perspective, falls under the protection of the First Amendment? And of course, we know that there's no amendment that is not without conditions. First Amendment does give us an awful lot of opportunities, including right here on this radio program, you publicly in many, many different settings, not only to comment about things, but also to be critical of people and even government. That is a part of our First Amendment. The question is, in the case of E. Jean Carroll, for example, does the First Amendment protect defamation? The answer is no, it doesn't. If, in fact, you've said things are false, they're provably false, and they've had some damaging effect upon an individual, that's a limit on the First Amendment. Likewise, the First Amendment does not encompass the capacity to incite insurrection, to encourage riots, to encourage violence. There is a limit. And the Supreme Court has said that in the past. There are limits on what the Fourth Amendment protection provides to all of us. I cannot overtly encourage violence and get away by saying, well, that's my First Amendment right. How is that determination to be applied here in this particular case? Certainly would be unprecedented for the Supreme Court to disqualify a leading candidate for the presidency of the United States of America. But these kinds of things, as we all know, we're going to use the word once again, unprecedented, right? Donald Trump's actions are unprecedented in the history of our nation. There is a lot before the Supreme Court. And the point of this exposition this morning in connection with this oral argument coming up is just this. My own prediction is that the Supreme Court will, in one way or another, not support the Colorado decision, put him back on the ballot. But it's got a number of different off-ramps, if you will, a number of different ways of doing that. Procedural things could find that indeed he was not afforded the proper due process in the Colorado Supreme Court. That's going to be a heavy lift. Just because it was a trial here, the trial court judge afforded witnesses the opportunity to come in, all sorts of testimony. That's going to be a difficult thing to establish, but maybe there's an argument there. But all of these other jurisdictional issues, who decides? What does insurrection mean? What does the 14th Amendment mean when it comes to political questions? Is that applicable here? All these kinds of things are things that the Supreme Court could and probably in one way or another will seize upon in overturning the Colorado decision, placing him effectively back on the ballot. The reason why this case is so important, of course, is there are other states looking at it to determine what the Supreme Court says in connection with their own invocations in their own states about Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. We know that Maine is awaiting the decision in this case, presumably coming up sometime soon, Trump versus Anderson, awaiting that decision to determine whether or not the Secretary of State's decision there to keep him off the ballot in Maine should be supported. Lots of things depend on this prediction. We will see. We will see. We can never tell exactly what the Supreme Court is going to do. We'll see, especially read some tea leaves from this coming Thursday to determine whether or not the Supreme Court is seriously entertaining the notion of supporting the Colorado Supreme Court or going in the opposite direction. Again, this is one where it's difficult to predict with certainty how they get to it. My own sense could be the subject of reasonable people disagreeing with me on this, which we always encourage. It may well be that they would disqualify him from that. But then once again would be a precedent-setting thing for the Supreme Court to do, likely that they will go in the direction, one of these other directions, and find that the Colorado Supreme Court was in some way, one way or another, erred in keeping him off that ballot. But it's got to decide it fairly quickly because, of course, all this coming up Super Tuesday, all of this, the other theme of 2024, timing as we go forward. Coming up as well in the month of February, again, two cases involving social media. And when we come back after this break, we're going to talk about a case called Booty versus NetChoice and NetChoice versus Paxton that have to do with the internet and social media, the implications, the relationships between government and the connections between things that are posted and monitored and taken down by platform providers out there. Stay with us following this break for that all-important discussion about other cases before the Supreme Court this coming week and in the weeks ahead.
Tap into what Chippewa Falls, Eau Claire, and the Chippewa Valley is talking about today. This is 93.5 The Tap. Online at thetap.fm.
CBS News Brief. The military says coalition forces have stopped a Houthi missile that was about to be fired at ships in the Red Sea. CBS's David Martin says that comes a day after strikes on Houthi targets.
It's unclear how much damage the U.S.-British strike did, but it was not enough to stop the Houthis from trying again. The
so-called atmospheric river is and will keep raining down on California for the next few days. CBS Los Angeles meteorologist Alex Biston.
Anywhere from 3 to 5, possibly 6 inches of rain for the coast and the valleys, and higher amounts possible for some of our foothill and mountain communities.
As the music industry honors its contemporary performers tonight, fans of a certain age will be watching for a rare appearance by a legend.
Joni Mitchell won her first Grammy in 1970. And it is amazing to think she's never performed at the ceremony.
The Observer's Joe Levy. The Grammys air tonight on CBS and Paramount Plus. CBS News Brief. I'm Peter King.
Aaron Jones be back. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens. Packers lost in the playoffs to the 49ers, and now comes a list of questions, including the fate of Aaron Jones. The 29-year-old running back missed at least 6 games with leg or hamstring injuries. Will he be back with the Pack next year? GM Brian Gutekunst.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we'd love to have Aaron back. We're still kind of putting all those things together as far as how we're going to move forward. But, I mean, he was such a difference maker when he was out there this year. The way our offense was able to move, he changed a lot of the way we operated when he was in there and when he was healthy. I think for us, it's finding a way to keep him out there and keep him healthy. But he was not only on the field, but just, and you guys know this, you guys have been around here. I mean, he's such an influential leader in our locker room. He's just really kind of the heartbeat of our team. So we're certainly, that's kind of the anticipation, is that he'll be back.
That's Packers general manager Brian Gutekunst. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. Some fog and some clouds to begin your day. Eventually, skies turning partly cloudy. Our highs reaching the upper 40s. In the overnight, upper 20s and mostly clear skies. On Monday, we'll see more clouds on the way. Upper 40s in the late afternoon. Right now, it's 51.
It's Black History Month, and Civic Media supports the importance of this observance. But what do you really know about it? I'm Calvin Butenhoff, producer of The Earl Ingram Show. Our Echoes of Empowerment Black History Stories will offer thoughtful answers all month long. Now, here's Earl.
You cannot talk about Black history without including some of the early music and art which flourished in the 1920s and 30s. Time now called the Harlem Renaissance. But this new Black cultural identity was growing everywhere. Trumpet player Louis Armstrong moved to Chicago. Painter Henry Tanner was accepted into the Academy of Design. Musician Robert Johnson recorded the Delta Blues in Texas. Listen for another Black History story right here on Civic Media. I'm Earl Ingram.
It's Black History Month, and Civic Media supports the importance of this observance. But what do you really know about it? I'm Calvin Butenhoff, producer of The Earl Ingram Show. Our Echoes of Empowerment Black History Stories will offer thoughtful answers all month long. Now, here's Earl.
The story of Black History Month starts in Chicago. It's 1915 and thousands are there to celebrate. 50 years since the Emancipation Proclamation and the end of slavery. The gathering also inspires civic organizations to uncover the many achievements of Black citizens. By 1926, the celebration of African American history is official. This also is a time for rising racial pride. The Black middle class is expanding, and industrial cities like Milwaukee are luring African Americans with good jobs. There's so much more to tell you. Listen for the next Black History Month story here on Civic Media. I'm Earl.
If anyone knows what's on tap,
It's the Chippewa Valley. We're talking about everything that's on tap in your world today. 93.5, The Tap.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
On the Shaw, 540 AM and 101.1 FM, WAUK.
Weekday afternoons from 4 until 6.
For our continuing discussion at this point in our Saturday morning broadcast about things pending before the United States Supreme Court. A big week next week as the Supreme Court entertains oral argument in this case, determining whether or not Donald Trump's name will continue to be on the Colorado ballot. Lots and lots of options for the Supreme Court, substantive, procedural, to decide that case, presumably long before May and June of this year, presumably sometime soon, in anticipation of balloting in Colorado and in other places around the United States of America. February is a big month in the Supreme Court. There are, in fact, 59 cases to this time in which the Supreme Court has granted certiorari on its docket. We've talked about many of those. It may well be that if this matter involving presidential immunity comes up from the D.C. Circuit Court, that could be number 60. And it's usually somewhere right around 60, maybe 70 cases or so. Supreme Court pretty much ends its taking new cases at or around those numbers. We'll see how those numbers play out in the weeks just ahead. But in the month of February alone, 11 cases, including Trump versus Anderson, on the docket for oral argument. And what are some of those other cases? Well, on February 28th, near the end of this month, a case called Garland versus Cargill, C-A-R-G-I-L-L. This is his major case involving the legitimacy of bump stocks. We've talked about this in the past. Whether or not the ATF has the ability, the power, the authority to provide and enforce a rule banning bump stocks. Bump stocks, once again, these mechanisms that basically convert rifles into machine guns. And based upon that capacity, ATF, the executive branch, maintaining that bump stocks should be subject to a rule, subject to prohibition under the administration of those rules, because you're converting them from a rifle to a machine gun, which by its very nature is illegal in America. That case coming up for oral argument on the 28th of this month, again, joining some other cases in the firearms area that we have also talked about in the past. Next coming up on the 26th, also this month, the 26th, a couple of cases involving the internet and social media. Let's talk about those right now. Florida and Texas, two state legislatures, Florida and Texas adopted laws that prohibit social media platforms from engaging what they call content moderation. Probably know what that's all about, requiring them to provide an individual explanation of every decision to remove material that's made by social media platform providers. In other words, if they're going to take something off their social media platform, they got to explain individually as to each posting why it is you're taking that off. Plainly, the product of some dissatisfaction with social media providers removing incendiary, inappropriate, inaccurate statements on their social platforms. Florida statute, it's SB 7072, applies to any platforms with an annual gross revenue of more than $100 million or more than $100 million in monthly users. And here's the significant part of this legislation. It prohibits the willful deplatforming. Deplatforming is the verb that's used. A candidate for office. You can't remove somebody from the platform because they're a candidate. You can't do that willfully. And in addition to that, a platform is prohibited from censoring, deplatforming, or shadow banning a journalistic enterprise based on the content of its publication or broadcast. That's the language of that law coming out of Florida, basically saying you can't censor,
You can't ban journalistic enterprises based merely on content. And if you do, you've got to provide an individual explanation about that particular decision to remove that content. It poses a huge burden upon, obviously, those social media providers that are trying in many ways, perhaps unsuccessfully, but trying nonetheless to try to monitor the content that's out there. The Texas laws, HB 20, is very similar. It just basically flatly prohibits social media platforms from censoring a user's expression or a user's ability to receive the expression of another person on the basis of viewpoint or geographical location. Very, very broad. The prohibition applies even if the viewpoint is not expressed on the social media platform. And by that, they mean that platforms cannot remove users or their posts on the basis of things that those people or those entities may have said in other settings. It's huge. Again, prohibiting those social media platforms from censoring expression on those platforms. Now, the 11th Circuit, the U.S. Court of Appeals in the 11th Circuit, already declared the Florida law, this first law that I described, as unconstitutional. And it stresses social media platforms, like all other private media companies, have the First Amendment right to choose what to publish. All important. By contrast, opposing, if you will, the 11th Circuit, the 5th Circuit Court of Appeals has upheld that very broad Texas law. And in its decision, emphasized that internet and social media companies should be regarded, as they said, as common carriers, and therefore they're subject to regulation to prevent them from excluding speech. Very different opinions coming out of the 5th and the 11th Circuit. Thus, the Supreme Court resolving not only this dispute between the circuits, but also determining what it is that social media providers can and cannot do by virtue of legislation, state legislation, basically telling them that you cannot remove content that is found to be violative of basic standards. So what are some of the information out there about the history of this? They do already do an enormous amount of content moderation, as I said before, maybe not enough, maybe too much, depending upon your particular perspective. But from October to December of 2021, for example, Facebook took action against terrorism content 7.7 million times. It took action to remove bullying and harassment 8.2 million times. And it took some action to remove child sexual exploitation 19.8 million times during that same period, October to December of 2021. In the last quarter of 2020, Facebook took action on an average of 1.1 million pieces of content every single day. So these cases coming before the Supreme Court, again, they're going to be heard oral argument on February 26th. The name of the case is, once again, important to note this for your calendars and understand what the Supreme Court is going to be deciding on these very important issues related to social media. Moody versus NetChoice and NetChoice versus Paxton. Yes, Paxton is the name of the attorney general in the state of Texas. Those coming up for decision by the United States Supreme Court. No great timing issue on there, but likely going to be issuing an opinion on those two, presumably consistent in both cases, sometime in May, sometime in June. And we will certainly be monitoring that, as we will monitor later this month on February 26th, these oral arguments before the United States Supreme Court, 11 cases altogether before the Supreme Court this month alone. Right now, the Supreme Court's overall docket, just under 60 cases to be decided in this 2023-2024 term. We've got some additional callers on the line. Thrilled to have a conversation this morning with all of you. First from Madison Joe, your comment or question on our Saturday morning broadcast. And Joe, do we have you on the line? I think you're there. We'll continue to wait as we pull you up. Joe, there you are. Very good.
Yes. Great. A great show, Jim. And I wanted to ask a question in reference to the 14th Amendment.
Yes.
And you were talking about the interesting situation we have here. We have this unprecedented court case when ex-president is basically saying, look at this, Section 3 of the 14th Amendment doesn't apply. And offers a slew of reasons. And one of the things I was interested in was your reaction. You had said, we don't really have a precedent because we've never had an ex-president do something like this. But we do have a precedent from the past in terms of Confederate leaders, generals,
yes.
Those politicians were not allowed to hold office. And as I understand it, they did not have jury trials about this. They did not have indictments. It was just accepted that if you were part of that establishment, it was understood that you had engaged in insurrection. And then in terms of present day, there is also this, back last year, there was a man who had been at January 6th and had been deemed
yes.
by a judge to have engaged. His name is, it's in Otera, New Mexico. His name is, first name is Cowboys for Trump, and his first name is Corey, C-O-U-Y, Griffin. And he court commissioner and was bumped from his job.
Absolutely.
Because he had engaged in insurrection. So we do have precedents, right? So in terms of what the Supreme Court wants to do, it could look to the past for the Confederates, and it could also to look to present day, to this particular gentleman. So I guess I'm just curious if you'd expand a little bit more on, couldn't they use that precedent to say, hey, you're not any different than any other citizen, you engage in insurrection, and this precludes you from gaining office by the 14th Amendment. Can you chat a little bit more about that, Jim? I appreciate it.
Be delighted to, Joe. Excellent points, as always. Let's talk about, first, this New Mexico case. Yes, we've talked about that case previously on this very broadcast, and it is the precedent, as you said, Joe, for an individual, again, previously been convicted in the federal district court in the District of Columbia for engaging the insurrection. So you've got a criminal conviction there, okay? Again, the extent that this issue relates about to whether or not criminal convictions can form the predicate for keeping somebody off the ballot, there is that precedent. It doesn't have to do, of course, with a candidate for the presidency. And, of course, that state elected officer there, not in Colorado, but in New Mexico. But there is that, and absolutely, that precedent, fairly recent, invoked by a state court judge there that says, you know, the 14th Amendment compels me, based upon your criminal conviction for an insurrection, to keep you off the ballot. And there the question is it self-executing? Doesn't need to be, because you've got the conviction already. Very important thing to note. And beyond that, will this issue about the post-Civil War removal from government with respect to those people who engage in the Civil War, having previously taken the oath of office, serving in the government, will that be argued? Absolutely. That kind of thing, again, especially when it comes to the decision about whether or not the 14th Amendment is self-executing, or whether you need a conviction, whether you need legislation, there will be argument. There will be argument this coming week that indeed you don't need any of that, Joe, as you most accurately have said. All you need to do is look to history. The precedent-setting aspect of this, of course, is we've never had someone run for president seeking to return to the White House when indeed they're on a ballot and a state court has said, we're going to toss you off that ballot because of your involvement. That's the aspect of this is precedential. But an awful lot of reference points, Joe, as you accurately note, that can in fact be invoked and will indeed be argued by the parties on both sides of this under any of these various rubrics, these jurisdictional aspects we talked about, deciding whether or not there's insurrection, deciding whether this is a political question, who executes this, all of that. There will be an argument that the Supreme Court should look to the past and should look to the recent past in saying that indeed this is how the law should be applied. Great points, Joe. Appreciate your comment. Also have calling in from right here in Waukesha is Kristen. Kristen, glad to have you with me on the program this morning. Welcome.
Hey, Jim. Regarding the social media case out of Texas.
Yes.
Am I understanding this correctly that if someone is harassing you in person, somehow,
right,
they can also harass you on social media?
Absolutely, it happens, right?
And you can't block them, and the social media company can't remove them?
Right. So
how does that run up against, like, stalking and harassment laws, if they even have those?
Right. Isn't that a great point, Kristen? Right? Again, Look at
that's
the
crazy.
That is both the I'll say that that's the legal word, Kristen, and that's the commonplace word as well, right? Look at once again at this Texas law passed by the legislature, endorsed by the Attorney General, signed by Governor Abbott, flatly prohibits platforms from censoring a user's expression or a user's ability to receive the expression for another purpose on the basis of viewpoint or location. And because of that, the platform provider prohibited from taking that person offline. Raises all kinds of questions, as you indicated, about stalking, criminal exposure, all those.
93.5 The Tap.
It's Black History Month, and Civic Media supports the importance of this observance. But what do you really know about it? I'm Calvin Butenhoff, producer of The Earl Ingram Show. Our Echoes of Empowerment Black History Stories will offer thoughtful answers all month long. Now, here's Earl.
You cannot talk about Black history without including some of the early music and art which flourished in the 1920s and 30s. Time now called the Harlem Renaissance. But this new Black cultural identity was growing everywhere. Trumpet player Louis Armstrong moved to Chicago. Painter Henry Tanner was accepted into the Academy of Design. Musician Robert Johnson recorded the Delta Blues in Texas. Listen for another Black History story right here on Civic Media. I'm Earl Ingram.
This is 93.5 The Tap.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
And this is our final segment on this Saturday morning broadcast. Thank you once again, all the terrific callers this morning, and also for continuing to listen to the very end here on our Saturday morning broadcast, talking about these major cases before the Supreme Court, social media cases, as Kristen was just commenting about the implications of those kinds of practical arguments, how these laws run up against the basic understandings about stalking and criminal prosecution, harassment, even defamation, if you will. And Joe also raising some very good issues also to be argued before the Supreme Court when it comes to this case involving Trump versus Anderson, and giving the Supreme Court some sense of the implications of keeping and not keeping Donald Trump on the ballot, looking back to history, both historical references, but also contemporary things, the implications of that for today in our political environment. Recently, about 2 weeks ago, the Supreme Court issued another very important issue opinion having to do with the enforcement of immigration law. And we've talked at great length before about the fight, if you will, between Greg Abbott and, yes, indeed, the Attorney General in Texas, the governor and the attorney general there, when it comes to the enforcement of immigration laws, a huge amount of reporting on that, of course, a huge amount of focus on that right now in front of our United States Congress. This has to do with who is responsible for enforcing the law on any border generally when it comes to immigration. We know that the Supreme Court is already has before it a major issue having to do with this decision by the executive branch to remove some of the concertina wire that has been placed along the southwest border by the governor and by other officials there. Well, about 2 weeks ago, the Supreme Court sided with the Biden administration and allowed federal officials actually to remove parts of that concertina wire along the Mexican border that the Texas officials, the governor, the attorney general had erected. Why did they do that? To keep migrants from crossing into the state. A major win, if you will, not only for the administration, but I would argue even more than a litigation victory, it's an affirmation of the Constitution. Why? Because George Mason, James Madison, all the other founding fathers expressly said that immigration issues, when it comes to enforcement of immigration laws, those things inside the purview of the federal government. And so by a 5-4 vote, a victory for the administration in this dispute between the White House and Governor Abbott. And of course, all of this related to this campaign that's being pursued by Governor Abbott and others in Texas to address this issue of migrants along the southwest border. No disagreement among Democrats, Republicans, independents, across the board. I suspect all of us, reasonable people out there, can agree that something has to be done about immigration. We talked about this a bit in our earlier hour when we commented about the obligation of the legislature to do something, to act, to engage in behavior, and to pass legislation to address this continuing festering problem that has to do with immigration. The system is undeniably broken, both in practical implication and also in its broad brush strokes. Now, we know that as a result of that, the governor has, again, placed this concertina wire along the barrier. And although the Supreme Court, in lifting an appeals court ruling that had prohibited the administration from moving that wire, the Supreme Court gave no reasons for its decision to overturn that decision and therefore permit the executive branch, the folks along the southwest border, our law enforcement authorities there, from going ahead and removing that concertina wire. What we do know from the Supreme Court case of a couple of weeks ago is that Chief Justice John Roberts and Justice Amy Coney Barrett joined the other three liberal members of the court, so-called, to form this majority. And so you've got two members of the Supreme Court joining, also Ketanji Brown Jackson and Elena Kagan and Sonia Sotomayor, coming up with this 5-4 majority, saying President Biden, the folks along the southwest border, the border patrol agents responsible for this, you may remove that wire. Why? Presumably why is because this is in violation of the fundamental establishment in the Constitution of responsibility for immigration in the federal government and not the state government. Lots of commentary in the wake of that. Plainly, the war continues there, and the disagreement about the concertina wire and many other things goes on. The attorney general, the governor himself, Governor Abbott, has vowed not to follow the rules and directives of the Supreme Court. And there is dispute right now. They're attempting, if you will, to prevent Border Patrol agents from removing that very concertina wire the Supreme Court said can be removed in the exercise of discretion, law enforcement discretion, along the southwest border. This particular issue, plainly not over. And again, raises an issue about the rule of law as a governor looks at the Supreme Court and says, we're not going to follow what you are saying, or at least not in practice, not yet. And so concertina wire becomes a major issue when it comes to the enforcement of immigration policies and practices in America, underscoring again the need for our legislature to work. The need for our legislature, as it is wrestling with right now, to pass some comprehensive law enforcement or directives and principles that will guide not only administrative law judges adjudicating all the immigration cases, that will address cases of asylum, a huge issue which we've talked about at great length. All those kinds of things have got to be addressed by our legislature. One of the other themes, of course, we talk a lot about in this show is this notion that many of these cases, many of these issues coming before the Supreme Court, why? Because the legislature is not acting. The executive branch, as one of our callers in the first hour indicated, sometimes very frustrated by the fact that it also not able to act when courts prohibit it from acting. Well, the legislature needs to act in these areas more and more in all these areas that we've described this morning. These kinds of things come to the courts, the district courts, the circuit courts, and yes, indeed, the Supreme Court, when our legislators, the people we send to Washington, D.C., have not wrestled in a way that brings to some conclusion, even if not everyone agrees with it. That will never happen in America, at least not today. But even if we don't have complete agreement on how, for example, immigration law should be structured, if we don't have agreement on environmental law, other things in the area of commerce and the economy, all of those kinds of things, they need to be addressed by the people through their legislature in Washington, D.C. We will continue to discuss all of these things and more in our future broadcasts here on the Saturday Morning Show. Appreciate, as always, your time, your attention. Value your contributions. Continue to call in. Continue to be a part of our conversation as we address things related to law and government and the administration of justice in this country, our United States of America. Have a good week, everybody. We'll be right back.
Whiny Lodge, and Carson Park. The entire Chippewa Valley is tapping in to the station talking about your hometown.
And all of Wisconsin.
93.5 The Tap. The Civic Media Network of radio stations across Wisconsin. It's your hometown radio. Refreshed.
This message is for Shauna, my mom, who just finished her high school diploma. I wanted to say I'm so proud of you for finishing school. You taught me it's never too late to achieve your dreams. I hope to make you as proud as you have made me.
When you graduate, they graduate. Finish your high school diploma for you and for them. Visit finishyourdiploma.org to find free and supportive adult education centers near you. Brought to you by the Dollar General Literacy Foundation and the Ad Council.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap.
WCFW HD2 Chippewa Falls, W228 Eau Claire.
And streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.